Welcome to the first episode of Notes from the Audio Files, Why Don't I Like Classical Music, which happens to be the title of our first episode. My name is Carmen, and this is my colleague, Pinky.
Hi!
I am an actual working freelancing musician in the San Francisco Bay Area for now, and Pinky?
I am a musicologist that actually has a job, sort of.
Maybe you should say what a musicologist does.
A musicologist studies various aspects of music, typically focusing on histories and sort of past cultures in regards to music and sound. But a musicologist can also do a lot of different things, including music theory. Some of us even play instruments still.
Very few.
Yeah.
In my experience.
Most of us spend some time in the libraries, digging through cool hidden archival treasures or reading books. But it's actually a really cool thing to get paid to study and think about music and listen to lots of music, like beautiful flute playing by Carmen.
Indeed. Well, we joined together for this project because we wanted to offer current and prospective audience members, as well as those who are just curious, some thoughts on what we musicians do and research via an easy conversational medium. Our intention is not to offend anybody, and we'll try to keep the profanity to a minimum.
No Donald Trump beeping here.
But if we get some hate mail, Brooke, I'll know that we've really made it in podcasting. It would be super awesome if people other than our parents listened to this.
I don't know if my mom is going to listen to this even. Maybe Rob, my best friend.
Since this is our first season, audience, we just thought it would be good to let you know that we have no money and we cannot afford to pay for licensing fees to broadcast actual recordings. It's something that we neglected to budget for. But you may instead get the pleasure of hearing us sing or play an excerpt. And if you love what we are doing and would like to donate, we will eventually be able to make that happen. So please stay tuned.
I just want to throw in, even though both Carmen and I actually have jobs in the music world, that doesn't mean we have money.
Because it also takes an enormous amount of student loans to get to where we are.
Yeah.
So, like I mentioned before, our first episode is Why Don't I Like Classical Music? And we thought an appropriate way to begin this whole venture is to look at the state of classical music today and why are institutions and organizations having such a hard time selling it?
Hey, and Carmen, before we begin, Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you like classical music?
You know what, Brooke? I do. I do love it. Ooh. I love performing it. But I think a lot of classical performers would also admit that they often don't listen to it on their downtime. And I would say the same for me.
Why is that, you think?
I think it's because we spend so much time and focus and energy on our instruments and our craft during practice sessions that it can just be very overwhelming to then turn on the radio or Spotify or iTunes and listen to it for pleasure. For myself, and I'm not speaking for everybody here, myself, it's hard for me to just relax and let go and not think so critically about what I'm hearing all the time. So it's kind of a curse in some ways that it's hard to just sit back and enjoy it for what it is as a practitioner.
Yeah, I think you've really hit the nail on the head. I have some friends who are music professors who listen exclusively to classical music, and it kind of boggles my mind. I know some people, especially older generations, have some kind of investment in consuming classical music as a genre. I feel like I'm in the same boat as you, where I I live and breathe this every day of my life now. And I've been doing so for a very long time because I was in college for so long. So when I want to listen to something, you know, sometimes, I will turn on the classical station when I'm, you know, scanning through channels in the car, especially if it's something, you know, late romantic or 20th century. But I would say 90-95% of the time, I'd rather listen to classic rock than classical music.
Right. I have a couple of comments. I hope I remember them. One of the things, so when I do listen to classical music, it's often when I'm in the car driving around the terrible freeways of the San Francisco Bay Area, which are almost always just filled with traffic. And I will turn on the classical station then, because sometimes it does actually calm me down. But I also want to mention that one complaint professional musicians have about local radio stations, local classical radio stations, is that, well, one, they never play complete pieces, like symphonies.
Oh, yeah.
And two, what they do play is often the greatest hits of classical music. So it's unusual for a radio station to play a Hugo Wolf song or a Mahler symphony even.
Mm-hmm. When you get over an hour, it is intense.
Right.
You know what? Something I do love is the Met Live, the Toll House Brothers Met Live broadcasts that have been a real sort of mainstay of classical music consumption, I feel like.
I've never listened to those.
Oh. They also do live broadcasts of San Francisco Opera. I've heard live broadcasts from them as well.
Right. Yeah, you do get some opera, full operas going on the radio.
But that's a whole different can of worms.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think classical music stations have their own dilemma in that they want to please their regular audience members.
Mm-hmm. It's the ones that are donating money.
Exactly, the donors. And they're more concerned with pleasing them, rightfully so, I think, than with people like me, professional musicians, who probably can't afford to donate a lot of money, you know, and so they're more likely to program the Beethovens and the Brahms.
Well, you know, what I think it really comes down to is an issue of canon, or sort of the canonic mainstays of classical music as a genre. And if you decide that there's a canon and that it's these composers and these pieces, then you cut yourself off from a lot of new works. Most people I know that I've taught or talked with think classical music ends in at 1900, basically, which is obviously not true. And most people are surprised. Normal everyday people that don't know anything about classical music think how is there classical music still being written today?
That's interesting. Right. Well, it's definitely, I think, a misnomer also, the term classical music, right?
Well, obviously, because classical music, what we call classical music in the normal world actually entails these different genres or different time periods that musicologists have artificially created in retrospect to define different styles of I don't even know how to describe it. How instrumental music, I suppose, is a way of putting it.
I've always tended to use the term Western art music.
That's probably the more appropriate term.
It sort of encompasses.
It's not as catchy as audiophiles. Why I don't like Western art music is a little bit more of a mouthful. But I think Western art music as a phrase is much more accurate, and it has a lot more, it illuminates the issues surrounding classical music. It is Western. It's considered art.
Right. Yeah, it does encompass better what is true, what is going on in reality today, and then in the past hundreds of years, you know. So some of these issues, I think, do come up when journalists or critics address the question of the relevance of classical music. And I wanted to just talk about, I'm going to start with this one article that I read. It's a Slate article called, Requiem, Is Classical Music Dead? And this was written in January of 2014. And, it's funny. There are a lot of articles like this.
Yeah.
It seems like there's a cycle of them. Somebody decides that it's time.
It's like we need something to print. Come on.
Right.
Let's turn out that Is Classical Music Is Dead article.
Right. And let's look at it again.
Yeah.
Let's poke a dead horse.
Yeah.
What is that saying? Yeah.
So remember, like, I feel like this was around the time when all of the contracts, the Minneapolis St. Paul Orchestra was facing dissolution. I know Philly had declared bankruptcy. The Philadelphia Orchestra had declared bankruptcy maybe the year or two before. Is that right? I'd have to check on that. But this was at a time like sort of when we were just sort of beginning to come out and recover from the Great Recession, I feel like.
Right.
And so many orchestras had been either, decreased in numbers of performances or totally dissolved. And I think maybe this was a culmination of that.
Right. Well, and then also, Minneapolis and Philadelphia, those are major American orchestras too. So the fact that even the
big ones, Stokowski's orchestra,
the big ladies, even they were having some issues was really shocking. So this article, let's see if I can get this right. It argued that, one of the things that's going on in today's culture is that our current culture values newness, and classical music is old.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of things that are old about it.
Yeah.
The players are old, the audience members tend to be old, and of course the music is old. Typically. So in addition to classical music having this aura of oldness,
mm-hmm.
it's expensive.
Yeah.
And the demographics tend to be old and white, more and more America is skewing away from that. And there seem to be requirements to go. You are expected to dress nicely. This one, the author of this article called the program notes incomprehensible.
Meep. I hope a musicologist didn't write them. I have read some terrible program notes, usually by artistic directors that don't know how to write.
Oh, yeah. Well, it just depends.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to write about music. I will concede
that. It's hard to write about something you can't touch.
Right, exactly. And you have to be quiet. There are these rules,
oh my
right?
Gosh,
you go
yes.
to a concert, and you're expected to act in a way that, let's just face it, you're not asked to be quiet for hours at a time, dressed nicely, and focusing for 2 hours on something you can't see or touch.
Yeah. I mean, at least at the movies, you don't have to dress nicely, and you can eat popcorn.
Right, right.
And you have a story.
And you have a story, so, that helps opera, I think, a lot.
Have you ever been shushed at a classical music concert?
Yeah, definitely.
So have I.
I'm not surprised. I have certainly, turned around in my seat to look at somebody who was talking or whatever. I can't remember what the deal was. They were probably, unwrapping a cough drop.
Yeah, as you say, when I've been at the Met, sometimes, like during a, of course, Wagner, you get a, if you get a little crinkle of a cough drop, the whole half the audience goes shh. They're the most like policing audience members ever.
You know, that just doesn't surprise me.
At least in America. Bayreuth might be worse.
I don't know. That's an interesting question. And then this article goes on to say, okay, there's other evidence of the death of classical music, all right? So overall sales are down, just not many people even buying records and tracks. There are fewer radio stations. The author cites that there are, at the time of the publication of this article, that Sirius XM had only two classical radio stations, which is kind of shocking. And the author also said, quote, live orchestral music is essentially a charity case, end quote.
Can I hop in on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I need to read this article. I probably read it a while ago and forgot about it, but I tend to do that with a lot of these classical music is dead articles.
Yeah.
But I think this point is especially ridiculous because live orchestral music has pretty much always been a charity case. It used to be sponsored by the aristocracy is really how we wound up with this like Western art music culture to begin with. And it was kings and queens and dukes and duchesses paying for this music. And so basically when this kind of orchestral music or instrumental music lost the patronage of the aristocracy with like the turn towards democratic republics in Europe and in the United States, if the state refuses to support classical music, then it's up to individuals.
Right. It's always been expensive.
It's always been a charity case. It's very rare that classical music has been profitable.
Right. Those two words just don't go together.
Yeah.
Profit and classical music, you know. Yeah, you're right. It's the more I research or read about classical musicians from the 19th century or the 18th century, a lot has not changed, I feel like. In the way that it's presented. And also in the way that musicians have been treated and what they have to do in order to survive, right?
Mm-hmm.
We started out as, you know, with the aristocracy, hired help.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Basically,
right?
House servants.
Right. We had to wear the uniform and we played after dinner and that was it. That was how we earned our keep. And then when you fast forward to the 19th century with pianists like Chopin and Liszt, who are really like on the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
concertizing. And
yeah,
it's that just what I can't imagine that would be fun, riding across Europe in a stagecoach for hours and hours, you know, to play a concert in which people are probably eating their dinner and talking
playing games. Though
right.
It's getting a little bit different. Yeah, especially in the salons where Chopin would play. And, like, Chopin made a lot of his money off teaching because of
it.
Did
he?
Yeah.
Oh,
he was actually a really sought-after piano instructor, primarily young aristocratic women who were practicing at home.
Right. Well, and again, that's like the way it is now, I feel like.
Well, and then Liszt, you know, did all the arrangements of different pieces. So it was like you could actually make the money with the sheet music circulation more than anything.
Right. So it's that like passive income.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a great way of putting it, passive income, yeah.
In response to this Slate article in January of 2014, The writer William Robin, later that month, also in January 2014, wrote a New Yorker article called "Classical Music Isn't Dead."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm surprised Alex Ross didn't write it instead, because Alex Ross is the the music person of the New Yorker, but maybe he was busy writing something else.
He thought it was frivolous and stupid.
He's like, this is beneath me. I don't even need to address this question because it's obviously not.
Well, again, it's like you have these cycles of conversations about it, you know, it's, and from what I've seen, not a lot changes from year to year in these articles. There's no profound revelation about classical music. Mm-hmm. They just kind of rehash the same stuff.
Yeah. Here, but, I'm looking at this article by Robin in the New Yorker where it's focused on the idea of classical music in the United States, it seems. Would you agree with that?
I don't remember, but it does seem like he does focus on that mm-hmm. in my notes.
Which is really fascinating, I think, you know, sort of highlighting what kind of cultural work this genre of Western art music does in the century of America that is really now over. But you can see it's really interesting if you look at more recent articles talk about classical music in Asia. I remember in the 80s it was like, oh, all the Japanese children can play violin so much better than the children in the United States. And now it's all the children in China who are learning violin and piano and tiger moms pushing their Asian children to master classical music. So it has this kind of like weird global cultural capital.
In William Robbins' New Yorker article, he says, quote, "America in the mid-20th century found classical music a useful tool for convincing the world of its cultural prowess." So I think that's what's happening, you know, in China, is that people use it. They use classical music as a sign of, like, cultural elitism.
Mm-hmm. Like, we've made it, basically, now.
Right, yeah. We have turned it into that. And it's actually that same elitist stance and is what is, if any, you know, if there is anything killing it, that is a huge part of it, I think.
Yeah.
So it's this weird, like, reversal now. We used it to show Europe that we are just as cultured as they are, and we've just, like, pursued that so hard, and now it's backfiring, mm-hmm. you know?
But it's also, I think the sort of, like, backfiring has produced a lot of cool fragments or remnants of, if classical music, whether it's dead or not, is definitely crumbling or transforming into something different in the 21st century, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Out of necessity.
Yeah.
Right. You have all of these people, a lot of musicians coming out of conservatory training, highly skilled, very creative, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also very intelligent, I think. So yeah, they're gonna see that and ask themselves, well, you know, like, where do I take this from here?
Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like Kronos Quartet sort of spearheaded that idea that you don't have to follow sort of the traditional paths of classical music, repertoire, and performance.
I don't know that much about them and their history. I can't say for sure. But there definitely has been a tide, a turning of the mm-hmm. tide.
Well, and like Yo-Yo Ma with his East-West Orchestra.
The Silk Road.
Silk
ensemble.
Road, yeah. East-West is what? Barenboim, right? I think.
Yes, yeah.
So sort of like the big names in the classical music world actually doing things that push the boundaries of what classical music is something that's really interesting, I think.
I can remember in the late 90s when I started my undergraduate conservatory training, that there was not a lot being talked about in the curriculum about the other possibilities or the necessity for thinking outside the box like mm-hmm. there is today.
Yeah.
It's everywhere in music schools across the country.
Yeah.
A lot of the top conservatories are starting their own sort of departments on, you know, entrepreneurial mm-hmm. studies. In
yeah,
music,
I was really
sort of
like, when I was in Philadelphia, I was going to school there, and then a nearby university, Drexel University, had just started a studio learning, like it was like a music degree, but it was for how to produce and record music for like a studio setting. And I remember seeing that, and I was like, man, I wish I could have done something like that in undergrad, or I wish I had knowledge where I could be. I think I would have, I don't know if you've seen Empire, but Cookie's my favorite character in Empire, and I'm like, man, I would have been a cookie, maybe in Nashville, where like I think I have the love and the ear for music that I could have done some really cool stuff in recording studios and producing artists that just wasn't even like something anyone talked about 10 or 15 years ago as an option.
Right. Except for maybe like the Berklee College, or Berklee School of Music.
Yeah.
Is that in Boston?
Yeah.
I think.
Well, and Berklee School of Music is also a lot more jazz oriented. Then
is it? I feel like
it's a lot more balanced,
right?
Than some other conservatories that we don't need to name. Are we good?
William Robbins also says, quote, "The industry remains relatively vibrant in the face of an American media culture that appears so determined to marginalize it."
That's a really interesting comment. I think we'll definitely like. I want to bring this point up in our episode on movie music. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a broad statement, too. And I wouldn't say that American media culture is trying to marginalize classical music. I think it's absorbed classical music in a lot of different ways, some that make it challenging, certainly. But then again, it's like we come back to it. You know, classical music, as it stood in the mid and late 20th century, kind of brought it on itself as this, like, elitist tool. So you're going to get poked fun at.
Well, the 20th century was an incredible time of change in American culture, of really fast changes, right? Mm-hmm. With the world wars and the devastation that led to. Artists reacted in various ways, and then you have pop music, rock music ascending, mm-hmm. and you do have, you know, television and just so many cultural changes that I think classical music just maybe wasn't keeping up necessarily.
Yeah,
so to speak,
in some ways,
you know?
It's so cool. For a while there, like in the 50s, and I want to say well into the early 60s, there were like television shows. Like CBS had its own orchestra and a CBS orchestra show, and like you would have classical musicians perform on, you know, probably one of the predecessors of Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. I have recordings of them. And you can see all these kinds of things on YouTube. So there was like a real, I feel like the 60s, maybe with like the culture, the social revolution and sort of, you know, rejection of the previous generation.
Right.
Maybe
rejection
is
of
where things really started to turn, I wonder.
Right. Well, and I also think that in academia, mm-hmm. classical music is becoming more and more rigid.
Yeah, no, well, that's something I've definitely seen. Like, there's some, and it's always like, so the upper tier schools are the ones, strangely, where there's less rigidity, I would say. And sort of the lower tier, middle tier and lower tier schools are where they're like, we need to stick to the canon. We need to protect our field because we're going to lose all our funding. And there's a real, like, anxiety about protecting things and maintaining things the way they were. Like, I've had people say, it's like, well, we didn't teach world music 30 years ago. Why should we do it now? And it's like, well, the world's changed a lot in 30 years. And hopefully, if you're trying to have a strong music program, you want to change with the world. But that's the way a lot of people still think. It's kind of shocking. I had a friend who famously, and this is like, you know, a famous quote, people fight so hard because the stakes are so low. So it's like this idea, this anxiety that, you know, especially now that the whole STEM movement's become the new thing, like, oh, we got to buckle down the hatches and blockade ourselves even
more. We have to, like, really prove our relevance.
Yeah. And that's why now you see all these, there's, like, all these classes about the science and books. Like, I saw a book at Barnes & Noble yesterday that was called The Physics of Jazz. And, like, the little blurb on back was like, jazz music principles can explain the world of physics right down to the tiny atom and up to the giant planets in the sky or something. I was like, are you for real? Like,
grasping at straws.
We're trying to justify jazz music with physics now.
It's a little sad.
It is. Like, I mean, I think that's interesting. I think, you know, thinking about music and science and sort of relationships is fascinating, but I don't ever want to have to justify music because of music's relevance because of some sort of other field that is more easily monetized, I suppose, is the way of putting
it. Yeah, totally. Yeah, like it's a fight to get people to recognize music's inherent value.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's the real problem. It's like music has always been a commodity, but it's also something that
it's an intangible commodity.
It is intangible.
You can't quantify how good it makes you feel. You know, right? Like these are things that I'm sure people have tried.
Oh well, yeah. That's the price of a ticket to an orchestra concert.
There's another article that I found that was written in October of 2015, so fast forward a year and a half or more from the first two articles that we talked about, and this is from Breitbart, and they're so, I love
what's
the title.
What's Breitbart? Is that a journal, or?
I think it's a, is it like a conservative journal?
Well, that would explain why it has an article on classical music in it.
Well, I mean, it's okay, it's really funny. I think it's funny.
Oh my gosh, I'm looking at some of your quotes.
Yeah, so we have to talk about this because it's very different. It's a different take on it, which is good. You know, someone's like bringing something new, okay, whether or not I agree with it. And the name of the article is, quote, the real reason for the death of classical music. As if this person has, like, finally solved the answer and we can say thank you, you know. And the author's name is William Bigelow. And this is written October 25th, 2015. And Mr. Bigelow says, quote, art is a reflection of the values espoused by its culture, not an essential pillar on which the culture stands. It is an ancillary aspect of the culture, not a fundamental element of its survival, end quote. And I was kind of like really shocked when I read that he's saying art is not an essential pillar on which a culture stands.
You know, I can almost
disagree with that.
I like my initial reaction is to disagree with it, but I can almost understand this position or this claim is that, like, art is a reflection of culture, not, like, the culture makes the art doesn't make the culture. If he's arguing sort of that, like, art is always a reflection of the time and the place in which it is created.
I mean,
but I think,
oh, well, he says,
I guess it depends, like, if you're talking culture with a little C or culture with a big C. Like, it's, yeah, this is a weird claim that needs untangling.
Yeah. So he says that Western culture stands on the nuclear family and Judeo-Christian values.
Now there's a problem.
And he says they're being attacked and eroded. So for him, culture, art is not an essential part of culture. And I guess I have this knee-jerk reaction to it because art is such a part of my everyday culture and life. Mm. And without art, without music, like, what do I have, you know?
Well, when are you going to start defending the family and Christian values, Carmen? Because
I think there are enough people trying to defend
them. Certainly where we're from.
Yeah. He then says, so the nuclear family, Judeo-Christian values are being attacked and eroded. This will lead to all Western culture, including classical music, to being destroyed.
Hmm.
Because that's the foundation, right? Yeah. And if you don't have those, then you can't have classical music or art. And then the best quote of all, I love this, okay, is, quote, when classical musicians are ready, willing, and able to defend the moral underpinnings and traditions of Western culture, then they will earn the right to demand that the culture support their artistic tradition, end quote.
Wow. So basically what he's saying is that orchestras need to play music that promotes the nuclear family and Judeo-Christian values, and then maybe they'll deserve government support.
I mean, that certainly sounds like that's what he's arguing.
That reminds me of Stalin's Soviet Union.
Oh, boom. Snap. I don't believe him, for one thing. Like, that's...
It's appalling.
I mean, it's like... It's really appalling. He's saying, like, classical music... He's implying that classical musicians are, like, these heathens, you know... Dancing to the...
Well...
I mean, we're like... It's just so funny of all
the people to attack. There's plenty of death metal artists he could have brought up instead.
I mean, like, I didn't exactly... I've never viewed classical music as an institution as something that's eroding the foundation of Western culture.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
maybe from Bigelow's point of view, classical music cultivation is a liberal part of a liberal agenda, it sounds like, which
is surprising. I mean, yeah, and that's just it. It's like classical music has all of these associations with it that are they true? Are they not? You know, is it elitist or is it not?
Mm-hmm.
Is it left? Is it right? Because I think our donors come from all sides of the spectrum, political spectrum, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
All throughout the political spectrum. And are we dead? Are we alive? Are we stuffy? Are we vibrant? Like, there's a lot of accusations and about it. And maybe... That contributes to why classical music is having such a hard time defending itself, defending its right.
Yeah, because it is, I keep thinking of, like, classical music is like this amorphous blob that has all these different sort of, I don't know, protrusions out of it, like different characteristics that seem disparate, and it's all these things simultaneously. Like, I was just looking at, like, one of the most interesting things happening, I think, in classical music right now is sort of a return to salon culture, especially in, like, urban environments, mm-hmm. but even in, like, more, like, suburban or, like, smaller cities where you have outreaches where, say, orchestras play in a park for free or in... like, I was reading about New York City and these sort of, like, loft productions called loft opera, where they put on an opera in, like, a warehouse or someone's loft, and you can hang out, and it's a lot more like going to a show, like, of non-classical right. music than going and sitting around in a seat for, like, 2 hours. You can, like, walk around, right. you can have a beer. I'm not sure if you can talk to people. That's one of my things. I'm like, you know, for hundreds of years, this kind of music wasn't like just, we didn't just sit there and listen to it. We used to, humans would eat dinner, like you said, drink, talk, play games, have sword fights, have sex. Like,
did they really?
Yeah, no.
What?
Is, yeah. Count of Monte Cristo has a great, great scene. Set in a, I think it's an opera box or an orchestra box or something.
Oh my goodness.
So this whole like sort of calcification and sort of mummification of classical music is really a recent, a relatively recent occurrence that I think is starting to be turned around in a lot of interesting ways by the millennial generation because they're young. And a lot of them did go into tech stuff, and they have money, unlike us.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, too, is like, okay, well, who has a loft? Well, someone who's got a lot of money, yeah. that's who.
Well, and Loft Opera is based in Brooklyn, and they're, of course, sort of like the center, the nucleus of hipsterdom.
Right. But, and I don't know if that's actually solving anything, right? I mean, maybe it solves an outreach problem in trying to get younger audiences.
Oh, yeah. I think, I mean, like, I'm very pro it. Like, I went to Philadelphia has something where they have, you know, the Fringe Festival. I think Fringe Festivals are all over the country at this point. But, like, there's, like, yeah. opera, like, one acts or opera scenes at these Fringe Festivals now. And, yeah, it's not always the greatest, but it's something, which is kind of cool. And a lot of times, like, maybe out of an hour of opera scenes, there'll be one or two that are, like, really striking and do something totally different and are kind of exciting and scrappy in a way that mm-hmm. that I like.
Yeah. So. Yeah, definitely. There is a sense of, for me... Even when I go to a classical symphony concert, like, you know, I want to be astounded. I want to hear something different. I want to hear a different treatment. And don't just play me someone else's recording of Beethoven 5, you know?
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll get into more of that in our talk on, in our podcast episode on sort of the rock stars of classical music, maybe. So I think that that's something that's working to change the resuscitate classical music, breathe some life into it,
into its old crusty body.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of, I can't figure out. I used to run. I have, you know, runner's knee. My hips are tight. I don't know how these 80-year-old people sit for 2 hours. I can't sit for like half an hour without moving. I'm, like, gonna die.
I think they sit a lot in their lives.
I can't. I don't know how they do it. I'm just, like, it's crazy. I'm, like, we need like, stretching breaks between movements or something.
Yeah, the seventh inning stretch.
Yeah. Well, especially, oh, my God, if you're doing Mahler, like, when the first movement's a half hour long. Whew.
Right. Maybe you have restless leg syndrome.
I don't know. I guess I should. It's not like that. It just gets, I'm like, I just get sore.
Huh. But. I don't know. I don't hear a lot of complaints about that.
I guess like some of the orchestras I've been in are really cramped. It's not as bad as flying, but it's almost as bad as flying.
There are some bad, bad seats. For sure. All right, so I just have one more article. Let me see here. That I just was written this month. Mm. Just 1 week ago.
June of 2016.
That's right. But was written by Anne Majette, I think is how you say her name, from the Washington Post, and she's their classical music writer. And her article is called "Desperately Seeking Relevance, Orchestra Grapples with Existential Questions." And she wrote this article talking about the League of American Orchestras and their conference that I guess just happened in Baltimore. And so there was a panel as part of the conference, and Maren Alsop, the director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, she said, quote, "We need to ask ourselves if artistic excellence is the ultimate goal. Other things may be important."
More important.
More important. Yeah. Other things may be more important.
I really like that.
You do?
I've never seen the Baltimore Orchestra, but now I want to. I think this director is asking the right question about artistic excellence, especially when you're like when you're representing a middle tier program, it's really important. Okay, yeah, so New York Phil.
What do you mean by middle tier?
I would say the smaller orchestra. Like, I guess now, what would you say the big three? I would say New York Phil, Chicago, Philly. Oh. Philly is lower upper or upper middle. I don't know where Cleveland and San Francisco stand. I would say San Francisco's upper tier at this point. But I feel like those are the big three.
If you're like making six digits, if those musicians are making six digits,
I feel
salaries,
like Chicago and New York are the ones that I think of as unassailable. I think Philly is doing really good now, but I think Philly has really fulfilled its niche. But like smaller places like Baltimore, like Dallas, the Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm trying to think of
Okay, so like upper,
they're not like Podunk Symphony Orchestra, but they're not the major symphony orchestras of the United States. And I think this is right. And I think maybe, you know, so Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, they're fabulous. I'm sure all those players are incredible.
Well,
I'm sure their conductor is incredible.
Job. Yeah,
but they might not ever really produce like the most perfect recording of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and it's like or Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and I don't think that necessarily needs to be the goal of any or all orchestras. I think you can play Beethoven 5 to get audiences in, but maybe there is something more important than artistic excellence. Maybe bringing new works, shedding light on new works, or shedding light on works that have been forgotten because they were by African-American composers or women composers, is a lot more important task of an orchestra than playing Beethoven 5 for the 100 millionth time.
I'm curious about what exactly Maren Alsop means by artistic excellence. Because the way I can kind of read into it is that artistic excellence means, like, you're not just a musician, you're an artist, you're creating something extremely effective. You're moving, you're communicating with your audience member in a very meaningful way. That's, to me, what artistic excellence means. Hmm. And I'm wondering if what she
I assumed like that. Her meaning is simply means execution.
Right.
Musical execution.
And so I think
is what
I'm
what
wondering if what she means is that we are aiming to be too perfect.
Yeah. I think that's how I interpreted this.
Okay. So that you're in effect, like, you're aiming for this perfection, mm-hmm. like getting every single note in tune at the right time. And there's just so much energy being spent on this pursuit that you are losing the the life and the music.
Yeah, no, I've seen, you know? I don't know if you've had this experience, but I've seen orchestras. It was even like the Philadelphia Orchestra under two different conductors. It was a totally different orchestra.
Right.
Where
yeah,
I saw
completely.
One where it was it was either Dutoit or Eschenbach, who are both, you know, obviously really esteemed conductors, but they were, it was just sapped of vitality. I've never heard such a boring Mahler 7 or a boring Rite of Spring.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I love Rite of Spring. Rite of Spring is the craziest, coolest piece, I think.
Right. Yeah.
But there's something where it's almost too clean, where it needs to be, it needs roughing up. Like that kind of music. Yeah. Okay. Mozart, early Beethoven, Bach, Handel, whatever. That's a different kind of style. But when you're playing, like, I want to hear the grit in music. And you know what? This is on a tangent, kind of, but I heard this, and I don't know if we're going to talk about it even in our podcast, maybe at some point, but the sort of Baroque and Baroque instrumental movement, performance practice, where I heard a recording of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, a piece I hate because it's so boring. We've played it since seventh grade, I think, in orchestras. One of the most boring, stupidest pieces of music, I thought.
I think we're going to get some hate mail.
I will. I know. There's probably some Vivaldi crazies out there.
Okay, keep going.
But I heard a performance practice recording of it where it was on period instruments in the in the style of what we think it might have sounded like in Vivaldi's time. It was so freaking cool.
Wow.
It was like heavy metal meets Vivaldi. It was, and I was blown away. I couldn't believe it. I still remember it, you know, 5 years later because it was so striking. I don't off the top of my head, but I bet we can probably find a link in YouTube or something.
Okay.
Just the, it was this gritty, raw coreness of the sound. It wasn't pretty. It was music. It was musical. That's it wasn't pretty, but it was still really musical.
Right.
And I think that was a lot more powerful.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Because I don't want, as a performer, like, I don't want someone to come away from my performances thinking, oh, her vibrato was so beautiful. Like, I want someone to go away thinking, oh my gosh, like, what an experience. I feel so alive, you know.
Well, I think that's the same thing, like people that are crazy about Maria Callas talk about her voice, like her technical abilities. Some criticized her technical abilities, but there's some sort of quality about that balance between these sort of like unique picadillos of her voice that bring out something and evoke an emotional response in a lot of listeners that a technically perfect voice simply can't.
I think pop music singers have more leeway.
Yeah.
With that.
Yeah, well, look at like Dylan. Dylan's
right.
Can't really hold a pitch.
You
or
just can't
anything.
Understand it.
Yeah, you can't even understand the words, but there's something about, yeah, the grit, what we call the grain of his voice that is so attractive.
Right. There's something about it, yeah. So I don't know how much that's true today with auto-tuning and whatnot. But yeah, there's such a wide variety of pop singers, you know, quality of voice and whatnot that some people do stand out just for that.
I know style. Some people are obsessed with Adele's voice.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting one. Like, what do you think? Do you have a suggestion for a solution?
Well, I think for me, like what I was saying about loft opera and sort of other smaller forms of music making and music outreach that aren't in a concert hall context, I think is really important.
So you think the concert hall is a real turnoff?
I think the concert, like, I don't think classical music is dead. I think the concert hall is dead.
Ooh.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
And that's, I think the concert hall needs to die. Like, that's one of the really cool things about having this education in music history is discovering that how we consume this kind of Western art music isn't how it was always consumed.
Right.
At one point, classical music was popular music. And it's something that I think should a lot of sort of the stodgier proponents of classical music should be reminded of. It's supposed to be fun. And right. I don't know, I think people get caught up in, like, it needs to be edifying and it needs to promote a certain kind of moral value system. And if I've paid $500, I expect this. And
yeah, yeah. No, I talked to a few friends of mine about this. And one of them, and they're musicians, and one of them said, I asked them specifically about, like, the dress code for going to a classical music concert, and she said, yeah, I expect someone to, like, be dressed nicely.
Oh, really?
See, so for her,
huh?
Yes, for her, it was kind of an occasion.
Ah, see, I've also, like, one of the cool things, like, I know a lot of orchestras do, like, Philharmonics do student nights or student rush tickets. So, you know, I've been to orchestras with my backpack, orchestra concerts with my backpack and with blue jeans and a shirt on. Not a t-shirt, but, like, you know, blue jeans and a blouse. I've been to the Met in blue jeans and a backpack.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't really, I mean, I've also been to the Met in big poofy dresses.
Right.
I got a lot more attention in the big poofy dress.
Yeah, I bet you did.
but I don't think classical music in the United States needs a kind of dress code or rigidity. Like, I mean, I've been to orchestra concerts in Europe. Granted, not like, you know, I just went to the local orchestra when I was living in Germany and the local opera. And for €7, I could go see Wagner.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it wasn't, you know, like the Met or Bayreuth, but I saw a Wagner production for €7. I saw a Peer Gynt suite with puppets. I saw Mozart opera. And so it's like, there's just this different approach in Europe, maybe because they don't have the anxiety of needing to prove the sort of cultural elitism of this music and stuff. It's a different relationship. And, or something.
Maybe.
But like, there were tons of people there, in jeans, you get beers, and you can bring the beers into the concert hall. I guess you can get beer and wine at most orchestras nowadays.
But yeah, at intermission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least, unless you live in a dry state or something.
Oh. then it's just too
bad.
But
I feel like, yeah, there needs to be less rigidity about appearances, I think. I can understand not wanting people to talk. Though I was interested, like, I noticed in this Baltimore, this article you brought up, that they were experimenting with an app, like, it was sort of a live app.
Right.
Of, that, like, gave you in real-time program notes, like, you can hear this horn call, and it's a quotation from, say, it's a quotation from Beethoven 6 or something. Like that's kind of interesting. And I've also heard of concerts where they have audience members live tweet the concert.
Yeah, yeah. That's been something
which
that
is interesting.
One of the regional orchestras, I think,
yeah,
around here has. I don't know if they do live tweeting, but they've encouraged audiences to take a picture of the orchestra and put it on Instagram or something, you know, with no flash, of course,
yeah.
Or take a selfie and post it on Instagram. So there's a sort of, there's a participation element in that way. Yeah, I don't know what the solution is. I don't, as a performer, I would just be happy if people came, and I think it would be nice for more young people to to be in the audience. For me, I've always felt like music education is where it begins. That's our future audience, you know.
Yeah.
Are the people who study the trumpet, or they study the oboe, or they study the bass, you know, and they may not go into it, that's fine, you know, but they've learned an appreciation for it, and they're not scared of it, and they know what it takes to do that.
Yeah.
And it's sad when you hear about music programs being cut, because I don't think that's doing right the culture of a city any good, actually.
If our hometown had not had a music program, I would be in a much worse situation than I am right now. I am positive of that. And I look, like I was involved in music, you know, at a really early age and very into it. And then I look at, you know, other people that weren't, and I'm, you know, especially like my brother, and it's like night and day, like the impact music had on my life. And music was always, was there for, you know, me at a really hard time. You know, middle school, high school are not easy times for anyone. And I think arts in general are something that gives so many kids like this outlet that's really needed.
I'm sure we'll talk more about the value of music.
Definitely.
Throughout the
even classical music.
Even classical music. When I was doing research for this episode, I was reading through, you know, because there are forums, like people pose a question, is classical music dead? And people will respond and say, a lot of people will respond and say how it makes them feel. And I was surprised at how optimistic I felt after reading all of these people's personal experiences with it. And because I want to say that there are more people like that writing in than the people who disliked classical music. So maybe it is just a matter of, like, getting people into the audience. I don't know what the solution is, honestly. I don't think it's dead. I don't think it's going to be dead anytime soon. I don't think that's going to happen. I think music is something that everybody responds to.
Yeah. How about we wrap it up with that?
I think that's great.
I think so, too.
I think this was very illuminating.
Yeah. Oh, my God. We got over an hour of material, too.
Yeah.
So I think our show will probably be about an hour long, I imagine.
Oh, there's one more thing we need to record from. We need to thank the conservatory.
Oh, okay.
Let me look at our grant here and see what I actually wrote. I think we just need to say... I'll just make something up right now.
Okay, go for it.
Okay. We would like to especially thank the San Francisco Conservatory of Music for giving us the startup money to pursue this podcast. And I would like to thank Jason O'Connell from SFCM for his tremendous help in enlightening me and telling me how to use electronics, basically.
Thank you.
Thanks.